Coming up on Tech News Weekly, the assumed innocence of the 10-year challenge. Also, the Apple Maps deal that DuckDuckGo scored is a big win for privacy. And never-before-heard-of console says it's going to be better than the next-generation PlayStation and Xbox. Are they slightly mad? All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 67, recorded Thursday, January 24th, 2019.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Start your new career in IT or level up with flexible IT training from IT Pro TV. Visit go.itpro.tv/TNW to take advantage of their biggest sale yet. Standard memberships are just $29 per month. For an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription, use the code TNW30 at checkout.
And by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software helping small business owners thrive. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/TNW.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where every week we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Let's jump right into it. It may already feel like a distant memory thanks to the dizzying velocity at which we navigate memes and trends online, but it's only been about 2 weeks since everyone participated in the 10-year challenge. That's where people, if you remember, would share their profile pic from 10 years ago right next to their profile pic from today. It was all good, clean. Wow, look how much I've changed, fun. But Kate O'Neill challenges us to think differently about it, and she joins us now. Welcome, Kate.
Hey, welcome. Thank you. Thanks
Absolutely.
For having me.
It's great to get you on. I'm happy we can make this work out. So you wrote an article for Wired last week where you dove into the possibility that a challenge such as this could actually be something, I don't know if sinister is the right word, but something beyond what people think it is just good, clean fun, maybe something more than just simple nostalgia. Tell us a little bit about your original thesis in that article.
Sure. So, you know, originally I'd say it was more of a thought experiment than a thesis.
And
one of those types of things that you tweet as an observational hypothesis. And I didn't expect it to really take off the way it did. But the idea was, you know, you're providing this two photos side by side. It's a sort of curated data set of what people looked like 10 years ago and what they look like now. And what I played out was, what if someone collected all this data and used it to train an algorithm on age progression for facial recognition? And that turned out to be a wildly popular idea. And we got to explore a lot of related concepts around it. And I'm glad that people are having this discussion. It seems like such an important thing for us to dig into.
So is there a part of you that wonders if, like, by saying that, light bulbs went off for people and they're like, wait a minute, we could totally do that. Let's collect all the data set and do that.
So it's my fault now.
No.
I do think that it lit some data, some bulbs for people on a variety of fronts. I think from a user standpoint, people were thinking, I hadn't made the connection that the data that I share in social media could be harvested in this way. And I feel like we go through these sort of stages, like Cambridge Analytica, I feel like was a moment of awakening for us, where people got to recognize that their participation in games and memes could lend itself to, you know, uses that it wasn't intended for.
Yeah.
And we got to see, I think, with this, at least this exploratory discussion, how that could be true in ways that weren't quite as sinister as Cambridge Analytica or didn't necessarily manifest themselves that way. So it's sort of more of a nuanced discussion that I'm really relieved to hear people engaging in.
So what did you make of Facebook's response? Like, they felt like they needed to come out and say, no, this is just a harmless meme. We didn't start this. It was natural. What do you make of them feeling like they had to come out and say that?
I do think it's kind of funny. It was unprecedented that a company like Facebook would make a public declaration in the comment of a tweet. So that was on the Wired editor's tweet of the story. I don't know quite why it began to be so commonly associated with an accusation that Facebook had engineered this thing from the beginning. But clearly that was a misconception that went wild. As I explained, I wrote a blog post on my site, koinsights.com, and sort of explained, like, I don't think that matters, whether it was Facebook or not, whether someone designed it from the beginning as a way to collect this data set or not. It began to be that data set. And that's more the point, is that there's a certain type of participation online that follows a pattern that once we're asked to participate in a meme or a game that's, you know, structured in a certain way and asking us to provide a certain set of data, I think that's when we should begin to be, you know, a little bit wary and looking a little askance at, you know, who could collect this data, you know, who, not necessarily who has asked us for this data, but who could collect this data and how could it be used beyond how we intend it to be used.
Yeah, it's one thing to read your original article and think, oh, Facebook did this or, you know, may have done this on purpose. Obviously, that very, very likely was not the case. The other way to look at it is challenging us as internet users for however many years we've been online. We've become so comfortable with sharing all this information and not thinking about what exactly it can be used for. Now we're hearing about this a lot more and having to reanalyze this. It's almost like that's becoming more mainstream to do that for just the everyday person to think, whoa, wait a minute, I get all this stuff for free, but at what cost? And that to me seemed like the big message here is this is fun and it's enjoyable to do this and it's very interesting to see these photos side by side, but think one step further and understand what could actually possibly be done with this in a worst case scenario.
100%. I think that the world we were living in, you know, 10, 15 years ago, when most people got on social media and began to participate in online fora more frequently, was a world in which the greatest caution that we were mostly providing people was, watch out for what you share because it might come back to bite you if you go for a job interview or if you run for political office or something like that. And we're in a different time now. The technology has progressed and the amount of data collected at every turn in our lives has progressed. And I think the conversation needs to become more sophisticated so that people can become more sophisticated in the way they approach the technologies and their participation around technology. Sure. There's so much potential for technology to do good for us, to help our lives and improve human, you know, the quality of life and the convenience of resources and access to things. And just so many ways I think that AI and automation and all types of emerging technologies can improve human life. But I think we also need to be having the conversation about the ways that it can go wrong so that we can put sort of guardrails around it and make sure that we're making the right protections happen and having the right level of awareness about it so that those things don't happen, the bad things don't happen and the good things do.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people talking about regulation and privacy regulation. Tim Cook, for example, a lot of other people really bringing this to the forefront. But you sort of teach people how to manage their own data themselves to keep it private. And is that even possible? Like, I sort of feel like I've given up kind of managing my own data. It's like I feel like everything's out there. Am I giving up too soon?
Well, I think there's a three-pronged part of the discussion. One is that I think we need to think about the ways that companies use human data, and companies need to have a level of ownership and responsibility of the data that they collect that is human data and have an accountability for treating it with respect and using it wisely and toward business purposes that are aligned with the human outcomes that they serve. And then government needs to be part of the discussion because those incentives aren't necessarily always going to be there for business sort of out the gate. So government can certainly step in and has a role in providing legislation and regulation that help ensure those incentives that are for the best outcome of humans. And then that third piece is that I think we do all need to have an increasing level of ownership and accountability for our own behavior and our own data management. And there's ways that I think that's going to evolve in terms of how we empower people to sort of gather all of our data assets. We're seeing experiments with that around the world, and even Will.i.am was proposing in this last week discussions about sort of monetizing data or providing a structure where people have an incentive to own their own data in different ways. I know the GDPR in Europe has sort of leveled up this conversation. And I just spoke in Amsterdam in December, and they're talking about these very forward-looking ways of providing transparency of data to consumers and people in general. So I think there's a lot of sort of multi-nodes of conversation that are happening and need to happen in order to make sure that we're set up for the next evolution of technology and human relationship to it.
I want to take a step back and go back to this age progression thing, because I thought, I also kind of found it interesting. Like, that's just not something that I've ever considered as far as like face recognition. We're starting to get more and more used to this. You know, Facebook has it embedded in their settings. You can turn on or off face recognition so that you're notified when your face happens to appear in somebody else's feed. And I get that. But what exactly could something like age progression at its core, how could that be used in a good way or in a bad way, you know, based on this kind of like 10-year challenge data set that you were talking about?
Yeah. I think there's a couple of different possibilities. And one I floated in the Wired article, a few different types of ways that data could be used. One that's positive is that you could imagine how age progression in facial recognition could contribute to the ability to track down missing kids, missing people in general. But if the last known photo of someone who's gone missing is from years before, it would be very helpful to be able to age progress that photo to what the person likely looks like now, so that facial recognition applied to monitoring cameras around the city or around different parts of the world could potentially detect that person. That's a wonderful possible outcome. The on the less delightful side is the possibility that if you're using it, if some entity is using it to evaluate your age progression relative to the cohort of your peers, then that could affect insurance, for example. And it could mean that you are either paying more for insurance if you look like you've aged worse or harder than your peers, or you might be denied for insurance. And I think those types of things may sound dystopian and sort of sci-fi or paranoid, but I don't think that we're very far from those things starting to creep into reality. So it pays to be mindful of this stuff. Facial recognition, I think, is a powerful force we're going to see applied in many, many ways. And again, the kind of thing that could provide amazing utility to human life, and also could be something that gets used in ways that aren't sort of aligned with human outcomes. So we need to be aware of it. We need to be having that conversation and putting the right safeguards in place.
Sure.
It amazes me every time I go to Google Photos and it's able to pick out pictures of my dad from like 1960
crazy.
Or like my,
kind of seems like they've already got it figured out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like my 3-year-old daughter, and then it'll match it to her and she's 15 now. And it, you know, it's perfect. And they even do the thing where it's like, is this the same person? And I feed it all that data, just
right.
Giving it all to Google Photos. That's, because I liked being able to pull every picture of a family member out and look at them. So maybe the trade-off isn't necessarily worth it. But I want to talk about your book, Tech Humanist.
Yes.
It just came out. First, tell us, what is a tech humanist?
Well, so I think the idea of tech humanism is that there's an awful lot of ways that that business uses technology to further its objectives, and that the emerging technology that we see in the world around us is largely driven by business imperatives. So the opportunity, I think, is for business to become more effective and more profitable with technology while also serving human outcomes. So looking for ways that the business objectives align with human objectives so that as business succeeds, it brings humanity along with it. And I think this additional capacity that we're going to gain through automation, through robots, through artificial intelligence, and everything that we're going to see over the coming years has the potential to really solve human problems at scale. So if we can apply it in the right way, and we can really make sure that the business outcomes are aligned with you know, solving human challenges like hunger and famine or poverty around the world, and certainly climate change is one of the big areas we're going to need to address in the coming years. So all the ways that machine learning algorithms and artificial intelligence can help address those things in ways that address business objectives too, those are going to be increasingly important to find and make sure that we have the right models in place to make the most of that momentum. So this is the idea with Tech Humanist, is to give business leaders especially the tools they need to develop data models and technology deployment that amplifies and accelerates the sort of human-aligned purpose in their organizations so that the business is successful and so that humans are enjoying the benefits of that.
That's awesome. Kate O'Neill, author of Tech Humanist, and some wonderful articles on both Wired and your own site. Where can people follow all your work online?
KOinsights.com is my website, and I'm prolific on Twitter at Kate O. So I hope to see you there.
Awesome. Kate, it's been awesome talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon.
So coming up, we are going to continue this conversation on privacy and talk to someone who runs a very successful company without selling his customers' data. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. The IT sector held strong in 2018, and the demand for tech talent remains steady. There's no time like the new year to start a career in tech. But you don't have to go back to school or sit through another boring slideshow snooze fest. Level up with interactive and flexible IT training from IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV offers over 4,000 hours of binge-worthy on-demand training from CompTIA and Cisco to EC Council and VMware. Engaging hosts like Don Pezet, Ronnie Wong, and Cherokee Booze present information in a talk show format. It's really fun to watch. They're live every day. Content goes studio to web in only 24 hours. Your team can stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on demand worldwide via Chromecast, your Roku. You can use your Amazon Fire TV. You can use your Apple TV, your PC, or any of their iOS. You can use their iOS or their Android apps. All of them work great, so you can watch on the go. 2019 is the perfect time for you to start your new career in IT or to get that certification that you've been missing. Visit go.itpro.tv. That's go.itpro.tv/TNW to get started with IT Pro TV and take advantage of their biggest sale yet, their video-only subscription. The standard membership is listed on their site at just $29 per month. It's usually $57 per month. Plus, you can use the code TNW30, and if you use that, you'll save an additional 30% off, and that means you can get started in IT or advance your career all for just about $20 a month. That's go.itpro.tv/TNW and use the code TNW30 for 30% off. IT Pro TV, flexible training, binge-worthy content, life-changing results. Recently, privacy-focused tech company DuckDuckGo announced that Apple Maps will now power its private search results. That means more accurate address searches, enhanced satellite imagery, and regular updates, along with the privacy that DuckDuckGo already provides. Joining us to talk about what this means is CEO and founder of DuckDuckGo, Gabriel Weinberg. Welcome back to the show, Gabriel.
Hello. Nice to be back.
So what powered the searches before this announcement?
So we were using Mapbox for our tiles and then a variety of kind of internal homegrown things.
So you, of course, if people don't know, you have a strict policy of not sharing any information, not collecting or sharing any of this information. How does that affect the search results?
Yeah, so we actually build our search results with like 100 different partners, Apple Maps being one of them. And that's why they can be so good. And, you know, people can switch from Google without really looking back. And so, for example, also in local results, we use Yelp a lot for, you know, restaurant listings. And so what we do for any partner, including Apple and Yelp, is we always proxy. So we essentially are like a mini VPN internally, and we proxy any calls to partners through us. So when you go on DuckDuckGo and you see like an Apple Maps, you're getting that Apple map directly from DuckDuckGo. And so we can make it completely anonymous to the partner. And that's what we do with every partner.
Now, among the really big tech companies right now, do you feel that Apple's kind of doing privacy right as far as that's concerned? I know Apple believes that they are. And, you know, some other companies like Google are definitely on the other side of that equation. What do you think they're doing differently?
Yeah, I do. I mean, and in general, we try to work with partners and providers that we, you know, are closest to our values when we can. I think Apple's doing a few things right. I mean, they're really pushing for stronger regulation. Tim Cook had an op-ed the other day on Monday than the other tech companies, which are really kind of more pushing for watered down regulation. And he's laid out specific principles, which Apple follows. And so one of them in particular that I really like and we take to the extreme, is data minimization, which was in the op-ed you're showing now. And what they do is they really try to collect the least amount of data that they need, and they go even one step further. They tried to push all the data that they do need onto the device and not actually send it back to Apple. And so there was this study that came out last year from Digital Contact Next that really did a deep dive on Apple devices versus Android devices and kind of how much location information and other data they're sending back and forth on a daily basis. And they found like literally 10 times less location information being sent back to Apple than Google on these devices. And that information is under a better privacy policy and whatnot. But just the idea that they're minimizing data, I think, is excellent.
So as a iPhone user, I have the DuckDuckGo app, which is just basically a browser that's more secure than using something like Chrome. Or is it more secure than Safari?
Yeah, so we've done in our app is, and in our browser extensions, which you can download for Chrome and Firefox, is we call it DuckDuckGo Privacy Essentials. And on the app, we call it DuckDuckGo Privacy Browser. And in both cases, we put in all the essential privacy elements that we think you need when you search and browse privately that you can get seamlessly, so without like breaking the web. So the main components are private search, of course, which we're most known for, but it also includes tracker blocking. So we're blocking like Google and Facebook trackers across the web, and encryption, where we're sending you to encrypted versions of sites when they're available. And we maintain the biggest list of that by far. And so when you use Safari by default, you're currently not getting that tracker blocking or the encryption piece. And when you use the DuckDuckGo Privacy Browser on iOS or use the extensions on Chrome or Firefox, you're getting those additional components.
I think what strikes me is that, and actually I mentioned this in the previous interview, is that privacy awareness, I feel like, is at kind of a mainstream type of inflection point right now. More and more people who were casually, you know, just using the internet and not thinking about privacy before actually are now. They might not know what to do about it, but they're concerned about it and they want to do more, which I think puts DuckDuckGo in a really great position. You guys have been stressing the need for more private search for quite a while now. And here you are, you know, you have the potential to kind of ride this wave at the forefront of it. Do you feel like your competition is going to feel kind of enough pressure from this kind of mainstreaming around privacy to follow in your footsteps? Or is there simply too much money to be made from data harvesting and all the things that come from the other search engines that are doing things differently than what you're doing?
Yeah, good astute observation. I mean, 2018 was really a game-changing year for this area. So much more. We haven't seen anything like that since 2013 when the Snowden revelations happened.
Right.
It really jumped into the mainstream in terms of privacy awareness, to your point. And just people, mainstream people, the majority of people actually seeking out tools. Unfortunately, to your other point, they're often seeking out the path of least resistance tool, which in a misleading way has not helped them, like private browsing, which we like to talk about. But to your central point, we hope that other companies, raise the standard of trust online with us, which is our mission, and we'll do things to make things more private. And so we've been a leader way before last year of like pushing Google to be encrypted by default, to not share searches with advertisers, you know, or webmasters when you click on links. And so we're basically happy when Google or anyone else kind of takes up that, or Facebook coming out with the clear browser thing, which is still not launched yet. But we're happy if they kind of react in that way. We don't think that they're ever going to go fully anonymous like DuckDuckGo, just because it's fundamentally opposed to their business model. I think that it's just not in the cards.
So let's say a person is like, well, I'm not, you know, the thing you hear all the time, like, I'm not doing anything wrong. Who cares? And maybe that same person doesn't even really care that they're being advertised to based on their personal information, based on their searches, their things they post. But you did a study about how the Google filter bubble. So talk a little bit about how even if you don't care about your privacy, using these services might change the way you think about things in maybe not the most positive way.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's the whole I got nothing to hide contingent, right, is what you're saying. And there's a few reasons why you should care, even though I do think people generally don't want to be creeped out by ads in general, for what it's worth. But beyond that, yeah, there's some more pernicious things. I mean, so the filter bubble piece is that you're getting results from Google. Facebook also does this as well, where they're showing you things in your feed or your search results that they think you're going to click on. And so if they're showing you more things that they think you're going to click on, they have to show you less other things. And what are those less other things? Well, they're the things that they would generally show other people. And so what you're seeing is not objective search results or kind of an objective news feed. You're seeing this kind of biased news feed based on what the search engine or, you know, news feed or another service or social network thinks that you're going to click on. And so what that leads to is not seeing enough diverse viewpoints. And then in the aggregate, it leads to more polarization and, you know, manipulation of elections and kind of the things that we're seeing. So on one level, people really, really don't like this. On another level, you know, there's just a basic kind of two other basic ideas for people who think they have nothing to hide. People don't like to be manipulated. So filter bubble is like one level of manipulation, but the ads are another level of manipulation of trying to convince you to kind of buy things or propaganda for the election side that you wouldn't normally see. And people like to think they're not affected by that, but study after study shows they are. And the whole game is rigged against them because the advertisers on these platforms of Google and Facebook can just run variation after variation, changing the image, changing the word, just making it as manipulative as possible. And then the third reason, which we often find resonates with people, is, you know, the companies are just making a lot of money off of your personal information and you're not getting any of it. I mean, it's just a basic, people are profiting off my information and I'm not getting something of it. It's just something people don't like. And that's what we're trying to do, is kind of let people take back that control of their data.
So if they're profiting off of people's data, the other companies, you know, that are doing this, you know, everything that you're talking about here, that obviously, you know, allows them to stay in business. Flip side to you guys, like how are you driving your business if it's not on the backs of all of this data?
Yeah, this is what's really interesting about search, and one of the reasons why we got into it initially, is it's a perfect place where you don't need a surveillance business model. And so search results, because you type in exactly what you're looking for, you can give an ad on that topic. So you type in car and you give a car ad and I don't need to know anything about you. And that basically is how all search ads work and literally how Google still makes most of their money. All their growth had come from in the past years have been using those search results and what you typed in to then have those ads follow you around the rest of the internet. And that's why you see, you know, things on YouTube or your Gmail or like the millions of other ads that they power on sites, you know, on newspapers and all other sites across the internet. We just run search, and so we can just keep that private and not have story or search history at all. I think if they were to curb that tracking back, they would still make most of all their money off the search ads without needing to do all the rest of that tracking. The same is true with Facebook, as another example. They don't really need to track you across the entire web to make similar amounts of money on their site if they were going to serve contextual ads, like based on the videos you're currently watching, knowing nothing about your history.
So is there then a solution for social media? Because that's where I get stuck. Like I don't really care for Facebook, but I'm not ready to give up Instagram. And I know they're owned by Facebook. I'm well aware of it and it feels, but
we
I like
a study,
it.
By the way, most people did not don't realize that.
Yeah.
Facebook
I'm
owns
not
Instagram.
Surprised.
Or WhatsApp or Waze for that matter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I know you guys know. So yeah, I mean, there's a couple things there. One, for Facebook in particular, you're right that I think people are realizing they are kind of willing to give up on Facebook. And there was some Pew research last year that showed people were actually taking a bit of a break. And I think that's great because there is other research out there that shows that it's actually literally unhealthy for you. I think for other social networks, I realize people don't want to give up Instagram as much, but I would try and find other alternatives. I think there are starting to be other private alternatives that are cropping up, other apps. That are also centered around photos that you could switch to. Me personally, I'm not in much of an engager on social networks except for Twitter. And so I felt that even Instagram is more healthy to give up, but I can understand and appreciate why people may not want to do that.
Well, Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us. Gabriel Weinberg is the founder and CEO of internet privacy company DuckDuckGo, who hopefully they're working on some sort of social media that's not going to use the same business model. I want that. You can find more at DuckDuckGo.com or go to their blog and read all about it. That is spreadprivacy.com. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
We appreciate it.
Take care.
All right, up next, a new game console that claims to solve all of gaming's problems. Slightly mad indeed. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by FreshBooks. Now is the time to set new business goals. And FreshBooks is the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software that puts you, the small business owner, in control of your business. FreshBooks is full industry-standard accounting for users of all levels. Even if you happen to be new to accounting, you can send professional-looking invoices in seconds. You're going to stand out when you do. You'll see sent, viewed, paid, and overdue invoices there. You can accept online payments, so you can make it easy. It's directly from your invoice even, so you'll get paid an average of 2 times faster. You can quickly generate and access accounting reports in the FreshBooks dashboard, see everything you need there, easily laid out, and you can share those reports with your accountant or financial advisor. You can also create proposals with rich text content and images and request your client's e-signature as they happen to accept proposals. It's all embedded and integrated. Send invoices, estimates, and proposals in multiple languages. FreshBooks automatically connects to your bank account and updates expenses daily, so everything's always up to date. You can import expenses in bulk, or even upload a picture of a receipt and then let FreshBooks do the rest. Well, using the FreshBooks mobile app, you can keep tabs on your business no matter where you are. It makes it really easy to keep up to date on the go. And the FreshBooks team is constantly adding new and improved features. So you're going to see changes and improvements over time. They've added an accounting and reports tab in the navigation bar for easy access to the numbers that matter to you. Their double entry accounting functions have 7 new features: cost of goods sold, other income, general ledger, trial balance, charts of accounts, accountant access, and balance sheet. Also new is the advanced payments, mark time as unbilled, revenue streams, and a whole lot more. I'm telling you, they're adding all the time. And if there's anything you don't understand, you can check out their award-winning support team, LED Learning Hub videos. Stop using Word and Excel for billing. That's just going to make things more complicated than it needs to be. Make 2019 the year you upgrade to FreshBooks. Try FreshBooks free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/TNW. Make sure and enter Tech News Weekly in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Look for that and put us in there. We'd appreciate it. That's freshbooks.com/TNW, and we thank FreshBooks for their support. After spending 3 months with him, I must say that I've missed talking about video games with our friend from Ars Technica, Sam Iskovich. It is so great to get you back on the show, Sam. How you doing?
Howdy, howdy. Doing just fine.
Awesome. Wanted to bring you on because I've been hearing, I know it's not the freshest news in the world, but I've found it kind of interesting nonetheless. It's the news that Slightly Mad Studios is readying, apparently, a console that they say is going to go toe-to-toe with the next generation of consoles. But maybe we take a step back first and find out exactly who this Slightly Mad Studios actually is. Are they new to the scene?
Yeah, this is a funny story that bubbled up, and this studio has continued talking about this plan to release a console, as in some sort of box that would compete with your Xboxes, PlayStations, and Nintendo Switches, with a focus on virtual reality and 4K gaming. The virtual reality pitch it came out very oddly because they had guaranteed 60 frames per second per eye for virtual reality. And if you're not really familiar with virtual reality, you may go, well, that's a lot of frames per second per eye. But that's not how VR works. And that was setting off a lot of red flags where people started asking, well, who is Slightly Mad Studios and what the heck are they talking about? Well, Slightly Mad makes a game series called Project Cars. And Project Cars has one of the better VR racing modes out there today. It only works on computers. This does not work on PlayStation VR. But if you get either of the Project Cars games, you can attach a virtual reality headset and have what I would say is a surprisingly comfortable virtual reality racing experience, which is hard to do when you're talking about high speed, drifty kind of cars. They still kind of make me sick. I'm not going to say it's the number one thing to play if you've never done VR before. But yeah, so Slightly Mad came out and said, hey, it was just a couple of tweets. And then the gentleman who was running Slightly Mad just started answering people's questions and answering questions of the press, including us at Ars Technica and folks at Variety. And then days later, after people started asking specific questions about all of the technical details they seemed to get wrong, they started releasing target renders of what the system would look like. Now, let's not forget Slightly Mad. You may have noticed I have not said that they've ever made any hardware.
Right.
This is not a company that's ever put out a phone or a controller or a steering wheel, let alone an entire CPU, GPU, RAM, cooling, et cetera, kind of thing that you would need to build a console that plugs into a TV at scale. And so they started just putting out these computer-generated renders that looked like something a college grad might have put out. And even the ones that are coming out now, this is another update from January 10th of a controller concept, another target render box. But the funny thing is, the creator of Simply Mad Studios, the man who's been telling Slightly Mad, who's been talking about this this whole initiative, one of his defenses was that he worked in a computer repair shop in the 90s. When people ask, well, how are you prepared to make a game system? His response was that he repaired computers. Now, I helped hook people's DSL up back in the late 90s or early aughts. I would not call myself a person ready to develop a cloud gaming platform. Like, it's just one of those things that all sounds slightly mad. And it was sort of this perfect catnip for dreamers with ridiculously questionable ideas.
And so he said, you know, this is 2 years out anyway. So in 2 years, he could learn how to make it, right?
If he can find, I mean, essentially, if he drums up the right production line, the right company and organization that is willing to invest and put serious legwork and experience into building a box, great. It just sounds to me like this is a guy who has a little bit of name cash and who had a crazy Twitter bender to try and get some venture capital drummed up, as opposed to something to take super seriously. I would say Slightly Mad is a really good choice of phrase. But he emailed Ars Technica in an interview and was talking about many vendors who are under an NDA and who are being worked with, which is, to me, kind of red flaggy to sort of announce all that. It sounds to me like he wanted some stories and some goodwill, and I'm not sure what news I can offer you that's going to be any good. But we at Ars Technica have followed things like the Phantom console, which was a vaporware product that eventually showed up in a Goodwill shop that people got to pick apart and found that it was just a really badly made computer meant to plug into a TV. Vaporware is commonplace, and 2019 really needed a good candidate for vaporware this early on to distract us from other terrible news. So we really appreciate that from Slightly Mad.
I want to be a collector of vaporware. Is that even possible? It's probably not even possible because it never existed.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, that's the thing. People go and get the system like the Pippin, which Apple didn't really put right? that much support behind. There's a great history of this sort of thing, and we don't have enough time on this show to talk about that kind of crazy.
I'm getting a little bit of the Ouya vibe from this thing, too, although the Ouya actually shipped, but it never lived.
Oh, yeah, the Ouya existed, and it was so bad. I mean, you showed those controllers from Slightly Mad. It's going to take a lot to convince me that a touchscreen in the middle of a controller and all of the buttons aren't going to be terrible. Like, it's very hard to make a good joystick and D-pad. There are a lot of companies who've spent years putting out like 7 or 8 controllers to finally get a decent one out. So hats off to them. Yeah, good luck.
There's some ideas there, at least. Let's shift gears a little bit. That was not an intentional pun. And talk about the games themselves. We're beyond the holiday gift rush. And you were mentioning that it looks like we're seeing some mature releases this month. I didn't even know that they were remaking Resident Evil 2, which is the classic from 1998. But apparently they are, and you've played it. What do you think?
That's true. I like to think of January as the Santa Claus for the kids who got coal kind of month in terms of video games. After the Christmas rush of the family-friendly things, you see these nichier, grittier games fill out the January calendar. And Resident Evil 2 is landing 21 years later as a complete remake. Anyone who's followed Resident Evil over the years, whether because they play the games or because they love Mila Jovovich in the films, I mean, if so, good luck for you. there's just been a history of good and bad and good again games. And there have been a bazillion games, a lot of offshoot series. But this is a return to the second Resident Evil game, which came out during the heyday of the PlayStation, where they had streamlined and tweaked some of the things that were awkward about the very first PlayStation Resident Evil. It was just a huge hit because there was anticipation and the dialogue wasn't nearly as terrible, but it was still cheesy. So now we fast forward to Resident Evil 2 as a remake, and that could be so many things. Are they going to do it exactly like the original game? Because Resident Evil 1 got a remake where they cleaned up and made it look nicer, but it still had the cinematic camera. And the cinematic camera was used back then, so they could only render the characters. Like, all the backgrounds were static. It was a PlayStation 1 trick so that all the humans could look a little
like
less.
Like a lockdown camera, basically.
Yeah, because the polygons were kind of limited back then. So, but this one, nope, they are fully revamping everything about how you play Resident Evil because the camera's hanging right behind you the whole time, which essentially is them saying, we'll make it cinematic with you as the cinematographer. And the thing that has really blown me away about Resident Evil 2, the newest one, the remake, is that they nailed it. There is an incredible amount of shadow and light trickery going on, and Capcom has their own proprietary engine. If you talk about video games in the modern age, you might hear words like Unreal or Unity or CryEngine. There are these different technologies that people can buy into and make games more quickly, and Capcom made their own. And Resident Evil 7, which was really, really good, was a VR-centric game. You didn't need VR, but it worked that way. And that their proprietary engine made things look smooth in VR, but kind of crappy, like bad details. But this game, the lighting, smoke, particles, monsters, gooey, gory, bloody entrail stuff, it is all incredible. And we may laugh in 5-6 years' time and think about how crappy it looks, but I'm absolutely blown away by what it just conjures up in terms of taking this classic thing of, oh, you know you're going to go into this abandoned police station and zombies are going to appear. That is the same plot as last time. And so they just say, all right, it's like going to a popcorn muncher of a sequel, like a Friday the 13th remake. You're fine with them going back to a summer camp because you want to see that classic creepy stuff revamped with new filmmaking techniques, or in this case, new game making techniques. It's just stunning, scary, creepy stuff.
How's the sound?
Oh my God. There is a surround sound option if you have headphones on, and it will, you'll want to keep a change of pants nearby, is how I put it. I'd say it's 25% typical horror movie sounds and 75% real trippy stuff. Frequency tricks, distorted breathing hovering through, these weird ambient sound kind of pastiches just being filtered into it. It's really impressive the attention that they put into sound. And that's when you are the one controlling the action and not quite sure when some sort of creepy thing is going to come out of nowhere, that sound design does a lot to just telegraph the anxiety without being super cheesy about it. Fantastic stuff.
Interesting. All right, I want to play it. Another old school classic got a remaster. Maybe January is just the month of remasters and remakes on the Nintendo Switch from the Wii, I believe. No More Heroes. What's your take on this one?
Yeah, No More Heroes was one of these games that landed when the Wii was huge, but not mature. A lot of people on the Xbox and PlayStation camps were going there for their mature games, and Killer 7 and No More Heroes were these games from a Japanese guy who goes by the name Suda51, and he makes these games that are just hack and slashy with just a huge drip of crazy storytelling, sort of a Tarantino meets French New Wave treatment of plot and meta narrative. And so No More Heroes, Travis Strikes Again is the name of the new one that's now out on Switch. This one's been out for about a week, whereas Resident Evil comes out tomorrow. No More Heroes, it's sort of a spin-off, not necessarily a sequel or a remake, but it sticks with the characters from that world, and it's very weird. And it's going to be a lot of people's first exposure to the series because even though the Wii was popular, No More Heroes only sold so much. It wasn't a blockbuster the way that Wii Sports or some of those other Nintendo hits were on the Wii. So you end up with a game that just has a ton of running around and slashing and comboing crazy different moves that are all kind of bloody, but you're fighting glitches in a virtual video game. The idea is that you have been transported into a video game console that was developed by the CIA, and you are exploring a very long, weird story that has a dump after dump after dump of text, because Suda51 sharpened his teeth on Japanese visual novels. There's a game called The Silver Case that his fans are crazy about, and he has imbued this, a lot of these action sequences, with interruptions of text and text and text, and it's all stuff breaking the fourth wall, making jokes about things like a Metacritic review score, which is a real thing that game developers worry about. All of these different little in-jokes about his older games and about how people receive them. There's cameos from other video games made by other publishers, and I don't know what they did to get the rights to some of these. Not to spoil it, it shouldn't be surprising to anyone who likes Suda51 that he would refer to his past, but it is wild.
Yeah, I love the style of this game. It's very, very different. Mm-hmm. Looks like a lot of fun.
I was just going to say that one. If you don't know what Suda51 is, tread lightly, because it is slow. But if you are into something that's French New Wavy on the Nintendo Switch, that's a sentence I didn't think I'd say in 2019. Right. But here we are.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of those games that fall into that category, right? No, this is probably the only one.
Yeah.
Sam Iskovich from Ars Technica. Sam, it's great to get you on. As always, thank you for hopping on with us today.
Indeed. Have a good creepy January, y'all.
All right. Will do. You too.
Bye, Sam.
Bye, Sam.
Who needs the internet to communicate when you have Windows and
a piece of paper? Oh, Windows, like Microsoft Windows?
No, actual Windows and a piece of paper.
That you look out of.
Yeah. This week, Erica Strong from Toronto posted a tweet about how every day she stares out of her office window at a cat in someone else's apartment. She posted a message in paper and pen. She used post-it notes. You can see that if you're watching. Little post-it notes asking what the cat's name was. And then the first picture was the post-it notes.
There
they are. And then the cat responded, or someone in the house that responded, his name is Marshall.
Oh, that's all you ever had to do.
So, yeah, if we don't need the internet. We don't need to worry about our privacy. Just post messages on Windows.
Although, from what I understand, it took weeks for them to get back with the actual name.
Yeah. So, well, it takes a long time for cats to use the printer.
That's true. Are we sure that the cat used the printer? Like to believe it.
That's what I would like to believe.
I mean, it looked pretty proud of the sign hanging above it.
This story is one that's just funny, and then it's crazy how viral it went. Like, just people,
you never know what's
like,
gonna go viral.
I know, you have no idea. And apparently, like, there were other people who posted pictures of putting, you know, that they had put their cat's name in their window because they just got tired of people asking. Like, this, you know, my name is.
Because apparently that's a
thing. Yeah, cats, I guess, stare out of windows a lot.
People should know what to refer to them as, even though they'll probably never meet that cat in face-to-face, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just in that creepy looking through the window sort of way.
Yeah.
Now it just feels creepy. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us, and we love to hear from you, tnw@twit.tv.
And subscribe to our show. Go to twit.tv/tnw, same place, and you can find all the ways to subscribe. Or just go to your favorite podcast catcher and search for Tech News Weekly, and you can find us. Also, follow us on the social medias. We have Twitter. We have Instagram. There's a Tech News Weekly account. There's a Twit account. There's an inside Twit account. If you follow the Instagram account, you can see my snake, which is no longer my snake, came to visit this week in
Google.
Now it's Carson Snake, came to visit this week in Google, so you can see some pictures of that. And if you want to tweet at me, I am at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to everyone who helps us do this show. Burke, John, Josh, Henry was in here earlier. Everybody who helps us each and every week, we really appreciate it. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.